Hi everyone, I'm Victoria Hunter.
Hi, I'm Hannah Plews, and we are the organisers of the Family Forum as members of the Role Committee. So welcome to today. So our topic today, sex and more sex, the sexualisation of young people. It's a very complex topic, very multifaceted. And as a mother of a 10-year-old girl, I found myself quite recently, when she was actually nine, her and a friend, they'd sneaked up to a bedroom in my house, told me they were watching a film about mermaids. But when I went and checked about 10 minutes later, they were watching the sexiest moments ever from Sex and the City. As you can imagine, I felt quite horrified and shocked, not quite sure how to handle that. So I'm hoping today, you know, as a mother, I might pick up some strategies for negotiating that tricky landscape with my daughter. As a teacher as well, over several years now, we've dealt in school with sexting, images that students are sending to one another. We've had the police involved in some of those cases as well. And also 15, 16-year-old girls have had breast augmentation and lip implants because for some reason they think they're not good enough. So there's loads and loads of things going on here in this topic. As I said, very, very complex. So really looking forward to our speakers' talks today, finding out more from that.
Yes, so we've got a great lineup of speakers for you today, all of whom have a vast amount of knowledge and expertise on the topic area. And I'd like to start by introducing our first speaker. We have Professor Maggie Atkinson. Maggie is a Newnhamite herself and was the second Commissioner for Children of England. Maggie has had numerous years' experience working with children and championing their rights. So over to you, Maggie. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. So what I want to do in this talk this morning is not least to signal towards the materials that I published when I was Children's Commissioner, and also to reflect on what's happened both before and since. A word of warning about what today is likely to look, feel and sound like. You can't talk about the sexualisation of childhood, and very particularly the subject I want to touch on, which is sexual exploitation and abuse, without being what my grandma would have called pretty close to the knuckle. This is not going necessarily to be easy listening or thinking territory. If you are highly sensitised by it, please feel free to leave the room if you need a breather. Because some of what the three of us will talk about, and I'm in incredibly esteemed company, I couldn't believe who else was speaking when I got the list. I'm still not quite sure why I'm also here, but there you go. it's not possible to confront this topic without being very close to it. And the closer you get to it, the harder it is sometimes to stomach some of the things you'll hear and be asked to think about. And I said on all our three behalves that I would say that at the very start of this morning. So I want to look at child sexual exploitation particularly, to whom it happens, where it happens, what it actually looks like and what the signals are that you may actually be working with or looking at a young person who's either in danger of or already being sexually exploited or abused. Where are some of the myths and realities that swirl in this territory? Because there are lots. And what are we as a society actually doing about it, and what more remains to be done? I also want to touch right at the end on the sorts of things to which the sorts of grooming that I'm going to be talking about bleed into other areas of territory. What else is characterised by the adult abuse of power over those who have none? Because it's not just sexual exploitation, it's other sorts of it. The first myth I'll bust is that the professorship is honorary. I'm an honorary professor of social policy and practice at Keele University, which is one of my alma maters. It's where I did my doctorate. And there's the other myth. I have a real one, doctorate, and I have three honorary ones. So I am, in fact, Professor Doctor 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 Doctor. It's fantastic. Jodie Whittaker, eat your heart out. Anyway, so this is me. When I was here, those of you here in 1975, I was Margaret Cragg and I did a history degree. And Fiona, who's just waving now, she and I were Newnham history students together at the same time. And it's great. It's always great to come across each other again. I did a postgraduate certificate in education in history, English and drama at Sheffield and then taught. It's interesting that in one of the schools where I taught, the demons of so-called South Asian male and masculinity were very, very prevalent in that school. A large number of the students I taught were first-generation arrivals from hill country that bordered between Pakistan and Kashmir. And we were in a community where very strictly arranged marriage was the norm for 16-year-olds and sometimes younger than that. So there was always an alert ticking when a child went on an extended holiday across back to where grandparents and parents had come from. That community was incredibly adherent to and observant of its version of, and there are many, many, many versions of, Islam. And there was a constant friction and set of issues to deal with in terms of being a woman in authority in an adolescent male environment where 70% of my students were male. And there were undercurrents running the whole time about who talked to whom, who went home with whom, what you wore when you were on the street, if you were a girl, if you were a boy, what you wore to a party or a disco, if you were a girl or you were a boy. And that kind of was the first pricking of my antennae, really, about adolescence being a lot more complicated than even we thought it was when you're in a particular sort of very tight-knit community. I taught in the school that, if you remember Shannon Matthews, whose mum hid her in the base of a bed, she would have been at that comprehensive school had she stayed in that community. And there were issues to do with a very parochially tight-knit white underclass of people who had had no employment for a very long time and who were struggling. And they were struggling very particularly with the growing mixed nature of the community in which they thought they lived and had ownership. And sometimes their behaviours in adolescent sexualisation were driven by a kind of macho territory claiming that went on, very particularly by the boys, but not always. I went on to work in advice and training, inspection and development in a variety of parts of the country. And then became a director of education. And where I did that was in Gateshead in Tyne and Wear. And in 2005, I then became part of the first generation of directors of children's services. Now, that's a really important role. To be a director of children's services, and that's the post that Sharon Shoesmith was in when she was dismissed by the Secretary of State wrongly, as it turned out. To be a DCS, what you are is supposedly, statutorily, in charge of and ensuring the coordination of every service for children and young people in your locality across health, education, social care, youth justice, family justice, the police, fire and rescue services, the voluntary sector, schools, FE and everything else. And you can be hauled onto the town hall steps and made to resign if anything goes wrong. It's one of the few jobs described in law. It's a vital job. It's a very, very tough job. It's a joyous job when you get it right. But it's worth reflecting that the role originated in the 2004 Children Act, which itself originated from the Every Child Matters Green Paper in 2003, which itself originated in the country's scared response to the death of yet another child who was abused and neglected in plain sight in front of services that didn't talk to each other and therefore didn't get it right for her. And her name was Victoria Climbier. That role also created the role I went on to after I stopped being a director, which was Children's Commissioner for England. I succeeded Professor Sir Ainsley Green, who was a very, very eminent paediatrician. And I have been succeeded by Anne Longfield, who came from a voluntary sector background and I think was a bit shocked by working with and in and next to the civil service. But then why wouldn't you be? The Children's Commissioner's role is incredibly important because there have now been 3 children's commissioners in all 4 of the UK nations, so we are 12 commissioners in. And the battles and the work remain the same as they've always been. They're always about inequality, poverty, exclusion and inclusion, the unevenness with which children and childhood are treated by this country, particularly adolescents. The work remains pretty standard in that it's driven by attempting to right the wrongs when a child is disabled, poor, black rather than white, male rather than female, female rather than male, adolescent rather than pre-adolescent. You do know, don't you, that they're great until they're 11 and then they go on their summer holidays into a chrysalis. And when they come out in September, they're monsters. You know that, don't you? Same kid, same house, same street, same family. Our approach to adolescence in this country is one of the reasons I would posit, and there is research to back this, that we fail properly to give them agency in their own lives. We disrespect our teenagers to a remarkable degree in this country. There was a survey done in London just before I became commissioner, which said, asked Londoners to estimate how many adolescents in the city, right across all 34 boroughs, Londoners considered were likely to be involved in violent crime. And Londoners said somewhere between 30 and 40%. It's 2. Even in places where there are gangs and there is street crime and there are postcode wars going on, it's nowhere near 1 in 3 children and young people. Should I tell you, you would know if that was happening. How many children live on your street? We need to get better at this because what happens as a result of our approach to adolescence in particular is we cease to listen. And my work as Children's Commissioner was very firmly about that. The Children's Commissioner is a role described in law. It's posited on the notion that somebody needs to stand for the voices, views and interests of children and young people. There are 11.5 million in England. There are slightly more than that if you add in those who are up to 25 with learning disabilities or other issues and those who've been in the care system. It's really important that even before the horror stories that started to emerge from places like Derby and Oxford and then Rochdale and then Rotherham, much more recently Newcastle, but also in church settings and in institutional settings. And I'm an advisor to the Children's Commissioner on Jersey, and they finally got a Children's Commissioner. And why? Because of the scandals in the care system on that island. Not because they feel that proactively promoting the voices and views of children matters, but because there had to be a response, a knee-jerk response, to a dreadful care inquiry written by Frances Oldham QC. What the Children's Commissioner actually does is to act on what people in services working with children, so the system, and very importantly, children and young people themselves, tell her are the issues of the day. So we worked with already known and still very active campaigners in this space, people like Whitney Isles, Carlene Fermin, Professor Jenny Pierce at Bedford University, the team at Middlesex, the team in Kent, the team at Canterbury, the team at UCL, to try to nail what it was we were starting to ask questions about as a result of having been approached by people to tell us horror stories that were then mirrored by what came out in Oxford and Derby and elsewhere. Nobody should run away with the notion that CSE, child sexual exploitation, we use the initials casually and in almost cavalier fashion. That's what it stands for, and it's a form of child abuse. Nobody should run away with the notion that it's new. I don't know what your grandma used to tell you, but my grandma used to say, don't talk to strangers. If a man stops his car and says, get in here, I've got some sweeties, run. Learn to shout, learn to kick if anybody tries to get hold of you. I was born in 1956, and I was being told that in 1960 and 61 because we went to school on the bus, and it was 4 miles away, and it was a service bus. And the anything could happen to your children was part of the adult knowledge in my society, in my community, in South Yorkshire, as I'm sure it was in many of yours. We know a great deal more about it, but it's not a new phenomenon, and neither are its partners. Who are its partners? Well, what we found, child sexual abuse within the family environment, which sometimes made those who went on to be exploited and abused outside almost kind of immune to what was going to go on outside, because what had happened at home had already deadened their senses and made them believe it was normal. Neither are new phenomena found in things like more general neglect. The child who turns up at school not only hungry and exhausted, but dishevelled and likely to be in the wrong uniform at the wrong time with no homework. Is anybody asking questions beyond where's your geography? Because if they aren't, they should be. Schools are safeguarding hubs and universes for many, 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 many children. Let's look at this properly and call it what it is. If it's abuse, what you're talking about is the deliberate withdrawal of love, nurture, affection, and the needs for support from children who can do nothing about it themselves because they are not the agents of the creation of their own existence. If you so strip back a child, their likelihood of vulnerability to those who would otherwise capture their sense, their being, their very soul, is markedly enhanced in comparison to those who are properly supported, loved and nurtured in other backgrounds and in families. Those partner agencies, those partner bodies, those partner abuses are stories for another day. We are concentrating today on the manifestation of those issues through sexual abuse and sexualisation. And don't run away with the idea that as a society, we live in this clean and glorious universe. My two fellow speakers will talk to you about why that's not the case, I'm sure. Where suddenly the horror of sexual abuse appears out of a clear blue sky. Because it doesn't. And I'm really looking forward to hearing my two fellow speakers expand on that somewhat more. We heard every possible stereotype of who does the abusing and who gets abused during our work on our sexual exploitation inquiry. And I'm going to take some of them down later in this talk. Because do you know what? When you stereotype, what you do is blind yourself to what else is happening. No child should suffer the way some of the children we met in this inquiry suffered. End of. And that was why, through the passion of my team, and the person who led on this for me was my deputy, Sue Borelowitz, who's also a visiting academic and still active in the sector. And she was joined by Carleen Furman, who now works at Bedfordshire University, was a staff member in my team at the time. At the heart of the work of the Children's Commissioner, any Children's Commissioner, is the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. It's worth you looking for this. It's on the UNICEF website in beautifully summarised fashion. It's the world's most signed and ratified human rights treaty. It's an international body instrument, and we signed and ratified it in 1991. There is one nation on earth that has yet to sign it, and that's the United States. But we're working on it. We're working on it. Because it's a treaty, it is not justiciable in English law. It's not incorporated, and it's not justiciable, but if you sign and ratify an international treaty, international law requires that every law you write must have regard to the treaty. We fail spectacularly in this country to abide by something we've signed and ratified, but that's for another day as well. But what it does is set out standards that we should live by, about protection, about nurture, about education, about physical and mental health, about the place of the child as a citizen now, not a citizen in waiting until the bus named adulthood comes rocking round the corner and they're allowed on. If you have children, they are citizens the day they're born, and they remain citizens for life. And the voice that they learn to express about who they are, how the world is treating them, how they feel about that, has to be listened to and then acted on. The central rights are enshrined in this convention, which make children rights holders, which means that everybody in this room and every adult you know is a duty bearer. If I have a right, others have a duty to ensure that that right is fulfilled, and children are no different. So, what did we look at? Do we know the numbers? What's the scale of sexual exploitation, which is the organised form of child sexual abuse that happens outside the home, but it's still sexual abuse? What are the issues? Can we describe them? If we sat a group of people down in a room like this, could we actually begin to uncover and unpick the layers of what's happening when a child is sexually abused and exploited? If we do that telling, will people walk towards it and say, I join you in your fight? Or will people run away screaming for the hills because it's just too much to contemplate that anybody could ever do that to a child? And we found everything on the scale of, we're absolutely with you, where's my suit of armour, to don't talk to me about that because it's horrid and I can't deal with it. In policymakers, in medics, in the media, you name it, we met that complete spectrum. But it's an ages-old perennial challenge. The difference in the 21st century is where it manifests itself, how it manifests itself, how it's organised. The difference is the relentless pressure of the always-on social media ideal of what sex is about, what it should look like, what you should look like if you're going to participate in it, what your mates will expect you to look like, what your mates will expect you to do. You don't have to go somewhere to find that material anymore. It's on your phone. And if your mum and dad have locked your phone down so you can't get at it, the person sitting next to you on the school bus who goes, have you seen this? You can't unsee it once it's been seen. So, I started this work in 2011. Sue was the leader of it on my behalf. My successor has gone on and published more because the work of a children's commissioner, it's a bit like a stream. The water keeps flowing and the people in the boat change. It's about the work, not the person. It's about the convention and the rights. We did 4 years' work under me, and Anne published in 2015 on the familial work because it arose out of our work in organised circumstances. And we published an entire suite of materials and they're still on Anne's site. If you Google Children's Commissioner for England, there's a publications section on that site and it's arranged by date and the most recent to first so that you plough through the pages and you will find the material. We published on the issue of pornography. Basically, porn is everywhere, and that was a quote from a child. You can't get away from it, and the difference is my dad's was magazines, but this is on the net, and that means I can get at it through my iPad, through hacking a school computer. You know, there are youngsters who've put the faces of their teachers onto pornography stars and set it across the entire school network because they're clever and they can hack. It is everywhere. The Secretary of State, then Michael Gove, asked for an accelerated report into what we were starting to find because the big cases were starting to break. Oxfordshire, Rochdale were starting to break in the middle. And we put him an accelerated report together and that's on the site as well. I thought I was the only one in the world was the first of the big inquiry reports we published. And what children and young people were telling us were, I thought I was the only one in the world in his world, in my abuser's world, in my exploiter's world, and he made me believe that he loved me. But I also thought I was the only one in the world in that nobody else could possibly be suffering what I was suffering. And therefore I kept quiet about it because I thought he loved me and I thought there was nobody else involved. And therefore the two acted with each other and I stayed quiet. Sex without consent, I guess that's rape. What we found when we looked at children, young people and their responses to a sexualised universe was that they had no notion of what the boundaries were, no notion of what the barriers were, partly influenced by what they were seeing online, but partly influenced by what the esteemed President of the United States calls locker room talk, where actually the conversational environment is such that what you do is talk about what you can do and what you have done, whether or not you can and you have. And that's also perennial. Adolescents have always done that. But it's further embedded in their psyches by the presence of all of this chatter in the E world. And they had no notion of what no meant. Somehow they had no notion of what the signals were when somebody thought it had gone far enough and they didn't want to participate anymore. And they wanted us to do some work on consent. And the new relationships and sex education curriculum, now statutory in English schools, one of the direct results of the work that we did with others, we never worked on our own because you can't as commissioner. There are always advocates and charities and campaigners and journalists and bloggers working in the same sphere as you and you join your voice to the chorus. With statutory weight and moral authority, I might add, but that's what you do. What they were saying was, you need to help young people to understand that they are in charge of their own bodies and they are in charge of their own consent and permission, and that actually no means no, just as strongly as yes means yes. We worked with youngsters who were in desperate situations, and if only someone had listened, was the report that arose out of a litany of things that were said to us about youngsters and families who'd gone to the police, who'd gone to social care, who'd gone to Barnardo's, who'd talked to the NSPCC, who'd rung Childline and been told, you're making a life choice, you're putting yourself in risky circumstances, you're not up close to the thresholds. And the final one, it's wrong but you get used to it, it was about gangs, very specifically about gangs, and about the trade, in inverted commas, of particularly girls, sometimes recruited by other girls, but certainly the trade in girls in the gang environment. There are also four videos available on the Children's Commissioner's website, but this is a relatively short talk, so I'm not going to show them to you today. They're all of that work, although they're in separate reports and we tried to theme each report with a very particular strength behind each of them. They all look at the incredible interwoven complexity of what it means to be a sexual being among the human race in a multicultural, diverse, always moving society that is also backed sometimes and invaded other times by a social media and a static media on hoardings and the sides of buses and all the rest of it that dull your ability to think, hold on a minute, is that all right? You know, that sense of a society whose senses have somehow been dulled is one of the things that came up again and again. So, how did we go about the inquiry? Well, you're very lucky as Commissioner because you have a statutory right to run a capital I inquiry, which is a bit like a select committee hearing in Parliament or a select committee inquiry in Parliament. It's a statutory power and you have to publish. You can't not publish and it's in the law. So when the minister says you can't put that out because it's too inflammatory and it's, oh my goodness me, you go, sorry, the law. It's the best job in the world, Children's Commission. We heard from children and young people in the first place who pushed us, switched on the ignition, if you like, but we then heard from them throughout what we were doing. We also heard from academics, from journalists, from lawyers, from advocates, from campaigners. They did field work all across England. I can't tell you where because of the sensitivities, because of some of the confidential information we were given. But they went, trust me, they went into all regions in England across the period of the inquiry and they talked to hundreds and hundreds of people. We called in evidence from every council, every police service and the entire health authority network. They did not have the right to withhold that information, although the health economy tried extremely hard. But then it always does. Information sharing applies to everybody else, not to me. Patient confidentiality. Excuse me. It's about power. That's all it is. Refusing to share information with another professional who's just as professional as you are, that just didn't go to medical school, is about power. And we won. So about 94% of authorities, about all of the police services, including actually the Welsh Police Service, and I was Commissioner for England, but never mind, and about 50% of the health economy responded. So we had a really big evidence base. We put out a further formal call for evidence and people wrote in by their hundreds and we took and analysed everything that came in. We went out to where lots of people can't go. We went into gangs. We were brokered into difficult situations with particularly teenage black boy gangs in South and West London. And we talked to them and to their girls because we were given permission by the gang leaders to talk to their girls. That's how complicated it gets. We went onto the streets, we went into networks, we went into places of danger, and we held formal witness sessions and took verbatim evidence like a select committee would for Hansard. We also worked with just an amazing range of campaign and advocacy groups, including the parents of the Derby girls, the parents of the Oxford girls, those girls themselves. We went and sat at the Old Bailey as part of their support network, eyeballing them as they stood in the dock, being re-interrogated and re-traumatised by barrister after barrister after barrister, those Oxford girls. We sought to understand and to analyse and then to report back really faithfully on the basis of evidence. My work relied on what's the law say, what does the research say, what do the children say. And without those three, nothing went out over my name. What's the law say and the convention? What's the literature say? What are the children saying? Because it matters that those three come together. You can't just state opinions. We sought to understand as well as what was actually happening, what the stereotypes were. Challenging the use of language, challenging easily held preconceptions which were usually inaccurate, challenging unwise professional choices. So one anecdote, we went into one area where the only concentration by the police and social care was on girls in the care system. So they were completely ignoring usually white girls in the care system. So they were completely ignoring a swathe of other victims and survivors. And the perpetrators they were looking at were entirely South Asian males. So they were ignoring the fact that, given that we are something like 93% Indigenous white British, most abusers are Indigenous white British. It stands to reason. But the police and social workers in that authority were only looking at this group of kids and this group of perps. And what was going on out here was Wild West, because their attention was somewhere else. And they didn't like it when we challenged them, but they've changed their practice. I'm going to give you a word of caution on the next slide. Just as if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism, not everybody on the autistic spectrum. If you've met one victim of child sexual exploitation, you've met one victim of child sexual exploitation, not all of them. We distilled to get this list from masses and masses and masses of international academic evidence, as well as what our witnesses were telling us, as well as what medics and others were telling us. Everything on these lists, and there are two slides, combines in different ways in the life of particular children. Not all of them will feature in all children's likelihood of exposure to sexual exploitation. But if you see, what we discovered was, if you see four or more of them in the life of a single child, the likelihood that you ought to do at least some more digging is incredibly foregrounded. So this child, who's always at school and always goes to the parties and always goes out to meet her grandma, suddenly decides that that's not going to happen anymore. Or they turn up but they're late, or they turn up and they're truculent, or they turn up and they haven't got an explanation, or they turn up but not on a Thursday, or and every Thursday they're missing. When they do turn up, they're out of sorts, out of character. You can't get a straight tale out of them. Somehow, also out of character, they have acquired a circle of new friends about whom they will not speak in your presence. They will not tell you who these people are because it's private and it's mine and you're my mum and I'm not telling you. Okay? They seem to have acquired and begun to be attached to a range of belongings of some value. A second mobile phone, jewellery, perfume, makeup, a new coat, new trainers, whatever. Or they may have sums of money that they would otherwise not have. And this is where other sorts of grooming start to come in. If they're carrying vast amounts of money, are they being asked by a gang to safeguard that money because it's the product of crime or drug running or whatever? If they've got hold of bling, as you might say, whose is it? Has it been bought for and given to them? Or are they holding it for somebody else because it's the product of a theft? The same power over the vulnerable is at work in those grooming situations as in CSE. They may become secretive. They close down their calls. They I've got to go. They hide their laptop. They cover the screen. They withdraw from contact. If you walk in on them unexpectedly watching the best bits of Sex in the City, they go, they do the, don't come up here, mum, I'm busy, from the top of the stairs. on a regular basis in ways that they wouldn't have done it before. You're looking for out of character. So they could be spooked, they could be out of sorts. Somehow there's somebody they've got to go and see, a place they've got to be at by a particular time, a contact they cannot drop. They go missing. And I don't mean, well, they're late home from school, or I thought they were going to be in Costa and they're not. I mean missing, off the radar. There's a pattern. There's a pattern of who they're with when they are missing. There's a pattern of what they tell you when they come back. If they're in care, there's a pattern of evasion when they do the return from missing incidents interviews. In the worst cases, they may well have physical symptoms, bruise marks, you know, if I hold your hand long enough, if I hold your arm back long enough, if I push you hard enough, your wrist will bruise. There will be marks. There are injuries they can't explain. There are injuries that they make up stories about. I fell off my bike onto the crossbar being one. Sorry if that's making you uncomfortable, but A&E colleagues meet that all the time. They may suddenly turn up drunk. They've never been drunk in their lives. You may smell the use of illicit substances, particularly strong cannabis, on them, and they can't explain where that's come from. They may start, and there's a typo there, that should say to, not top, to frequent places they would not previously have been to, with a pattern attached to that attendance. Particular parks, particular bus stops, particular takeaways, particular parts of the market square, with particular groups of people in particular times of day on particular days of the week. If you're a medic or you know medics, please note they could be frequent flyers at A&E, with unexplained injuries for the acquiring of which they may make up a story. They may be frequent flyers at sexually transmitted infection clinics. They may be frequent flyers at counselling or CAMS services. If health don't talk to everybody else and everybody else doesn't talk to health, you will miss that. Scandinavian dentists have found an incredible correlation, not causation, but correlation, between children who later turn out to have been sexually abused and mouth infections, tooth rot, gingivitis, and other conditions. I'm not going to explain why that might be, because I'm sure you can figure it out for yourself. I know of a young person with repeated quinces and extreme tonsillitis who was treated for repeated quinces and tonsillitis and not asked what she was doing to become so infected by anybody in any A&E clinic which she visited into the double numbers of times. We have to get smarter at this. And here are the mythbusters. They can be boys or girls. Boys are less frequently victimised than girls are, but they are. They will say less about it very often because of the masculine macho thing, but they are abused. They can come from any ethnic group and any cultural background. This is not Asian men on white girls. This is any ethnic group being both victim and perpetrator, any ethnic group or cultural background group being likely to be perpetrator or victim if these circumstances apply. They can come from any class or social group. I chair the local Safeguarding Children Board in North Yorkshire, and I will only say one word, and that's ample force. That's not the kid on the corner who's been at an emotional and behaviourally disturbed school. That's a child for whose schooling parents have paid. To be in an environment where there were decades of proven abuse. This is no respecter of class. They may well be unaware they're being groomed. They may think this is love. They may think this is what we do. They won't ask for help. Or if you offer it, they may refuse it, or they may refuse to comply with what you're asking for. And we looked at two distinct settings when we did this work. Gangs, which are usually peer-based, often male, with female adjuncts who are there to lure in other males or other girls. And they are seen as both trophies and trade, those girls. These are loyalty-demanding, brotherhood-selling, alternative family bodies, which are often geographically tight, defined by a subset of a postcode, not the postcode overall. They are denoted by a dress code, bandanas, wrist straps, laces in your trainers, subtler than just the colour of your jeans, but they are. And they always have a code of conduct. What happens in the gang stays in the gang. You don't tell, you don't blab, you don't talk, you don't grass. If you're dropped off in another postcode, it's your job to get home without being hurt. They're often adolescent. They're hugely ritualistic. They include initiation and appalling sexualisation and behaviours, particularly expected of girls for the favour of boys. And it's recorded in the reports and it's very difficult reading. There's your other health warning. Once you're in unless somebody helps you to break free. And then there's groups, the ones that hit the newspapers all the time. Looser alliances, older individuals, very often male. They may or may not know each other at all. Their predilection and their linked behaviours will seek to procure children for their sexual gratification. It happens in the straight community. It happens in the gay community. It happens in the lesbian community. It happens in the trans community. And it will be happening in every community in England somewhere. Whether it's loners or very tiny groups or the bigger organised groups like the 17 who were convicted in Newcastle last year. Trafficking within this country is common for these children and young people. They are moved from party to party, from house to house, from bed and breakfast to bed and breakfast. And a lot of training's gone into hotel groups and bed and breakfast chains and taxi drivers. These men and women form syndicates and children are trade. Is it always those others, those people out there who are not part of our social group, who are different from us? No. Categorically, it isn't. This is a very senior police officer who served in a 98% Indigenous white county community, rural, villages, seaside, you name it. And this is what he said, and he said it for the record. There isn't a city, town, village or hamlet in England where this sort of sexual abuse does not happen. It's the misuse of power by an adult who can exercise that power in the sexual exploitation of children who cannot defend themselves. So who's abused? Is it these other others, our white children and those black people and those brown people and these? No. People with existing vulnerabilities are likelier to be vulnerable to the approaches of people who are going to exploit or abuse them. But abusers are not only interested in those who are seeking comfort when their lives have gotten on. CSE is not a respecter of class, income, colour, or the setting in which you live your life. And let's be really clear here. When you think about people who talk about child prostitutes and risky behaviours and choice making, you, by law in this country, cannot consent to any form of sexual congress unless you are 16 or older. Let's just be clear here. There's no such thing as a child prostitute. They are abused children. We need to alter our language. They're not in a safer place than they are at home. They're not making risky choices. They're being abused. Since we published, people all over the country have used our signs and signifiers in health, in policing, in training for hotel proprietors, in training for taxi drivers and bus drivers and market stall holders and people who are just driving around the place and charities and you name it. But you have to retrain every time the staff changes. You have to keep it boiling or it will disappear. And the but, and safeguarding has improved, I would say, across all sorts of settings and in all sorts of organisations. The but, which we haven't got time to talk about today, but is important, is where else the grooming and abuse are taking place that isn't sexual. It's criminal. It's about the county lines stuff that you've started to hear about. The use of 12-year-olds to run drugs, to be accessories to crime, to be cannabis farmers, to be whatever. It's the same abuse of power as any bully, as any abuser, as any exploiter will use to get at and into and to destroy the lives of their victims. And that's what today's about. Where are your eyes open? Where are your ears open? And how can your thinking and your ability within your communities help to keep children safe? Thank you.